Chapter 12, Diurnia Orbital, 2358, July 7th. The afternoon sped by. Between the systems checks and updates, brainstorming with Ms. Call Me Mel Manus, and all the associated running up and down ladders from the bridge to storage lockers to data closets, I felt like I'd earned my pay. It felt good. At 17:30, I secured my station on the bridge and made a tour of the ship. I pulled up the ship's environmental sensor net and made the rounds as if I were on sensor watch tour. The advantage of that is that the sensor net is uniformly distributed bow to stern. Only the inside of the big cargo pod lacked sensors. It was my first real opportunity to go from bow to stern and examine every area on the ship. There was almost nobody aboard. It was the last night in port on a 4-day stay, and everybody who could be ashore went ashore. As I strolled through the various passageways and clambered up and down ladders, I found the same level of crud. It wasn't that the ship was filled with trash or anything, but little things like smudged light switches and built-up dirt in the corners and crevices. Almost every handrail on every ladder had some kind of deposit on it. Oil, dirt, paint, something. It was disconcerting. The exception to the rule was engineering. The actual engineering spaces themselves appeared to be maintained at a higher level. The fuse actors, sail generators, and associated equipment were clean and appeared to be in good order. I was no expert, but it sure felt better in those areas. I ended my tour on the mess deck. Dinner had started at 1800, and a couple of ratings were dining in. The mess deck, unfortunately, was a bit the worse for wear. There were sticky spots and deposits on most of the tables. It looked like a lot more than just the normal buildup from an afternoon's import activity. The deck was just short of gritty, and I could see dirt ground into the deck tile. The coffee urns were tarnished and looked like they hadn't been wiped down for a month, and that was just on the outside. I had a feeling I knew where the coffee problems started. Getting them solved might be harder. As in every other ship I'd ever been on, the import dinner mess consisted of a buffet with a hot dish, a soup, a salad, and lots of bread and cold cuts. The two ratings looked up, scowling at me, as I walked along the buffet. I smiled and nodded, ignoring the surly attitudes while becoming more and more disconsolate at the state of the ship. The food on the buffet was adequate. If the bread looked a little dried out, it had been there for a while. The cheese didn't look a lot better, and I didn't want to think about the cold cuts. I refrained from lifting the lid on the soup or the hot dish. The warmers didn't appear to be all that warm, and I didn't want to let any of the heat out. On my way back through the mess deck, I stopped at the table. The two ratings, an able spacer and a Spec 3 from Gravitation, both wearing a signature dirty ship suit, stopped and looked up at me. "Hiya, I'm Ishmael Huang, the new third mate," I said, and held out my hand to the one with the deepest scowl. She eyed my hand dubiously. "Able spacer Juliet Jaxton," she said, taking the offered hand briefly, and adding, "Sar?" I turned to her companion, an olive-skinned man who looked like he'd been beaten recently. He didn't quite flinch when I turned to him, but he didn't look up either. "Jinjiang," he said, "and yes, I know I don't look Chinese." I kept my hand outstretched, and eventually he took it, very briefly. "Nice to meet you both. You been aboard long?" I turned from one to the other, waiting to see who'd respond first. Jin answered first, but spoke into the tabletop. "Stanier," was all he said. "It's in my jacket," Jaxton said, again with a confrontational expression. I nodded as if we were indeed having a polite conversation. "Thank you," I said to her. "I'll be sure to look it up." If anything, her scowl deepened, but before she could reply, I breezed on. "Well, sorry to interrupt your dinner. Just wanted to say hi. It should be an interesting time in the deep dark." I nodded in what I hoped was a genial manner and left the mess deck. I rounded the corner into the passage and headed for the adjacent wardroom, and I heard Jin say, "From Sissy to Ishi," and chuckle nastily. Jaxton replied with a growled, "God save me from boot thirds." I kept on going. Either I had really good hearing or those people wanted me to overhear. And I was pretty sure my hearing wasn't all that good. My timing was perfect, though, and I stepped into the wardroom precisely at 18:30. Mel Manus was there and smiled at me from the sideboard where she was pouring a glass of water. She raised it to toast my arrival, and I smiled back. "Ms. de Groot not joining us tonight?" I asked. She shook her head. "No, she's gone ashore for one more portside meal before we get underway." David stepped into the wardroom at that point and added, "Can't blame her for that. Hopes you find something with some substance to it. Put some meat on those bones. He was smiling, but I got the sense he wasn't really concerned with Mr. Groot's frailness. Mel drank from her glass and frowned slightly rather than respond. He took a plate, rummaged through the buffet, plunked himself down, and began eating. Mel and I exchanged a glance and took our own turns at the buffet. As senior officer, she went before me, but waited until I joined the table before beginning her meal. David, for his part, just smirked and continued to eat. The hot dish was some kind of pork and noodles in a savory sauce. Even with my limited exposure to the culinary arts, I could tell this was a simple dish. The flavor of the sauce owed itself more to the pork and a heavy grind of black pepper than any subtlety in the chef's skill. At the end of my second day aboard, I couldn't decide if the food was just bad or if my sensitivity to the ship's odor caused my taste buds to rebel. Whichever it was, I thought I could see a contributing factor to the turnover rate. "So how was the afternoon watch, Ishmael?" David asked. "Run into anything unusual?" "Operations normal," I replied, keeping my tone carefully neutral. Mel shot me a glance across the table but didn't say anything. "How did you spend the time?" he asked, pressing me for details. "I went up to the bridge to get the system's backups run and to make sure all systems and comms updates are installed. I did a tour of the ship and met some more of the crew just before dinner." He made an exaggerated, "I'm very impressed" face, which did little to actually convey the idea that he might have been impressed. "And did you find anything interesting?" he asked. I considered my answer carefully. "I'm new here," I finally said. "It's not my place to judge. I can't tell what might be interesting or not. I'm still working on the context." "Context?" he asked curiously. "You're working on the context?" Mel looked interested but didn't give me any hint that I'd overstepped my bounds. "Yes," I said. "Every ship has a context. The ship, the crew, the officers, the cargo, the way it's run. All those things combine to create a unique context, almost a culture, wherein everybody understands their roles and positions, their responsibilities and benefits." David's eyes had glazed over, but Mel was trying not to grin. "And your assessment of our context so far?" David asked. "I'm still working it out," I said. "I'm in no position to make any real summary assessment yet. I'm a boot third in his second day aboard. What I know about this context wouldn't fill a teaspoon." Mel arched an eyebrow in my direction and a small smile went behind her glass. I shrugged very slightly in return and returned to my pork and noodles. David looked truly amused at my turn of phrase and finished clearing his plate, chuckling periodically and wiping the china clear with a bit of bread, which he tucked neatly into his mouth. Chewing thoughtfully, he pulled his coffee cup nearer and scanned the table, looking for the absent coffee. "Davies!" he called. "Coffee is customary with the evening meal." In less than a tick, the same girl burst through the door with a silver pot in her hand. "Sorry, Mr. Burnside," she said contritely. He scowled at her and pushed his cup to where she could fill it. She had to step up close to him to reach it, but she took the hint and leaned over to pour. She frowned a little in concentration, making sure not to spill it. As she was pouring, I could feel Mel stiffen in her chair. I glanced over to her, and she was studying her plate as if looking for a new subatomic particle. Her neck was reddened up behind her ears, but she sat very still. If I'd had to guess, I'd have said she was angry. That was curious, and I glanced back to the steward pouring the coffee. Yes, she was pouring from the wrong side, but what caught my eye was a flicker of movement lower down. From my angle, I could see David Burnside's hand caressing the back of Davy's thigh all the way up to her butt. He wasn't looking at Davy's or even at me. He was staring at Mel while he did it, and it was obvious from the angles that he'd intended for her to see. Davies, for her part, reacted not at all. She finished pouring the cup, placed the pot on the table, and stepped back. "Sorry to be late, Mr. Burnside," she said contritely, and turned to leave the wardroom. David picked up the coffee and took a sip. "So what else did you do this afternoon, Ishmael?" he asked blandly. "I spoke to a number of the crew. Opponents finds me humorous and seems not to have a firm grasp on the duties of a messenger," I said lightly. Mel looked at me sharply, but David just stared blandly. "Really? I've had no problem with his performance. Could you be more specific?" Mel shook her head. "Just a little bit." I took the hint. "I just asked him if there were any issues I needed to be aware of before I went to the bridge to work. He didn't seem to understand the question. Mr. Mallory provided an excellent synopsis of the situation, however. It was fine." David nodded, as if he'd actually heard and understood what I just said. I don't even think he heard me. Excellent, he responded. Well, I'll leave you to get on with the watch. I'll be in my stateroom if you need anything, he said with a smile. With that, he pushed his plate back from the edge of the table, took another sip of coffee, and stood to leave. Amelia, he nodded his farewell, and she nodded back without speaking. We ate in silence for another tick or two after he left. Then Mel shot me a glance out of the corner of her eye. Context? She asked softly. Yes, I replied, context. It's important to understand the context if one wants to effect a change. And do you want to effect a change on the William Tinker? She asked softly. Don't you? I asked back with a pointed look at David's empty chair. She shrugged a reluctant agreement before looking back at me. What do you want to change? She asked curiously. Well, as I said before, I'm new. At the moment, there's a lot I don't understand. Such as, she pressed. Why the crew is almost universally in dirty ship suits, for example? Why almost every deck in the ship is cruddy for another? Your engineering spaces are not that way, by the way, I noticed. She smiled. They better not be. After a few heartbeats, she asked, what else? Why the food is so bad? I understand cooking on a budget, and I sure know that import meals aren't generally high on the list, but this stuff is only marginally edible. And the coffee, gods, the coffee is disgusting. A short laugh exploded from her in a gust of breath. Well, you don't pull any punches, she said. How do you intend to deal with these issues? I don't know, I confessed. I haven't even met the captain yet. It may be that he likes it this way, and I'd be an idiot to go against the captain. As long as you recognize that much, it should be okay, she said with another smile. I'm green, Mel, I said with an answering grin of my own, but I'm not totally stupid. She chuckled. I'm glad to hear it, Ishmael. I'm very glad to hear it. It was a roundabout route, but on my way to the bridge, I stopped into the galley and was pleased to see that Ms. Kramer had gotten to the number 3 urn, and the coffee in it was as good as I'd hoped. I filled a mug and headed for the bridge. Arletta smiled as I climbed the ladder, balancing my coffee cup carefully. Betts eyed me curiously from the helm, but didn't offer comment. You about ready to get off watch? I asked, eyeing the chrono at the watch station. 23:40. I was still a little early. She grinned at me. How in the world did you fix the coffee? She asked me in a lowered voice. Me? I didn't do a thing, I objected with the emphasis on the do. It was all Ms. Kramer's work. She fixed me with a look. Yes, but you told her what needed doing, right? I shrugged. Guilty as charged, but that's just between us. And the mess crew, she said. I nodded a reluctant agreement. How long do you think that'll stay under wraps? She pressed. Probably not long, but it needed doing. It was her turn to nod in agreement. Still, Burnsy isn't going to like it, she pointed out. You're hobnobbing with the enlisted and giving advice to other divisions. Hobnobbing? I asked with a chuckle. I haven't heard that word in ages. She frowned at me. Yeah, I suspect I'm painting a target on my forehead, I said, but gods, I couldn't drink too much more of that mud without doing something. She sighed. I wish I'd known how to deal with it, she said ruefully. With a glance at me, she added, I've been drinking that crap for months. I gave a little one-shouldered shrug. See me between watches and I'll explain it, I said, with a glance at Betts. The chrono clicked over to 23:45, and I heard footsteps on the ladder. Jaxton, my helm watch, was just dragging onto the bridge, wearing the predictably grubby ship suit. Well, I think I can relieve the watch now, Ms. Novaya, I said pointedly. Ship is on course and on target, she replied formally. No incidents or actions. Standing orders are unchanged. You may relieve the watch, Mr. Huang. I have the watch, Ms. Novaya. Logged at 23:58, July 8, 23:45 per standing order. She stood, I sat. Jaxton and Betts changed positions with a few murmured words which included the current course and speed. I watched as Jaxton logged the watch change on the console, and then looked online to see the watch change in engineering and environmental as the names of the watch standers flickered and changed to the third section. Well, good luck, Ishmael, Arletta said. I'm off on my 24, so I'll be sleeping in tomorrow. I grinned. I'm sure we'll be fine, I said. Sleep well. She headed down the ladder ahead of Betts, and I could feel the ship settling into the only real quiet time it had during underway, midnight to about 0400. That's when the cycle would start again, when the galley started baking and getting ready for the morning meal. I sipped my coffee and looked out of the ports at the points of light out there in the deep dark. Aft, I could see the glowing Diurnian primary, Diurnia itself was falling away almost visibly, and the orbital was behind the limb of the planet. "Well, good morning, Ms. Jaxton," I said. "Looks like we'll be spending some time together." "Yes, sir," she said. It wasn't quite a sulky response, but one that spoke volumes about her outlook. I sighed and stood up from my station. Jaxton flinched at the movement as if expecting I was going to come at her. She looked quickly in my direction but glanced away when it became clear that I was just crossing from one station to another. At the systems console, I fired up the displays and put a schematic up. It showed the data and electrical flows in the ship. Each switch, node, and interlock was picked out in high-resolution detail. The consoles were far from new, but they'd been upgraded fairly regularly and were considerably better than what I'd grown used to at the Academy. I watched as the automated backups kicked in, rotating the logs and spooling the backups out to the removables in the closet under my feet. Straightening from the console, I stretched and began wondering what I could do to stay awake. I crossed to the aft observation port and looked out at the wide-bodied ship. I found myself shifting back and forth to see around the smudges in the armor glass. I looked at the glass instead of trying to look through it and snorted. It was covered in a layer of fingerprints, smudges, and what looked like a series of evenly placed nose prints that ran from one side of the 2-meter window all the way across to the other in an unbroken line. I chuckled. "Somebody had too much time on their hands," I said aloud. Miss Jaxton asked, "Sar?" "Oh, nothing, Miss Jaxton," I said, looking around and noting for the first time just how cruddy the bridge actually was. I'd been so focused on the systems and backups in my previous trips that I hadn't noticed that the bridge was as bad as the rest of the ship. "Miss Jaxton, what's the common practice on bridge watch?" I asked. "Depends on the watch, sir," she replied carefully. "And who's on it?" "I see. Thank you, Miss Jaxton. What do you think we should do for the next few stands?"
"Me, sir?"
she asked, apparently shocked by the question. "Yes, you. What do you think the two of us should do?" She looked at me hard, square in the face. It was an assessing look that I couldn't quite fathom, but I kept my features very still while she made up her mind. She sighed. "Well, sir, you're the officer here," she said in a sort of resigned voice. "What did you have in mind?"
"Well, I can think of a lot of things that need doing, but I suggest we get Miss Dang up here since she's part of this section."
I could see the confusion crossing her face. I was not sure what she might have been thinking, but given what little I knew about the culture of this particular ship, I was pretty sure she had no real clue about where I was headed. I just smiled a little, pulled out my tablet, and called a messenger the watch to the bridge. Charlotte Dang was one of those crew I hadn't met yet. Small, fine-boned, and quite pretty. She had a ready smile, but a guarded expression as she climbed the ladder to the bridge. She shot Miss Jaxton an apprehensive look before saying, "You called, sir?"
"Yes, Miss Dang. I hadn't had a chance to meet you yet, and since you're in my watch section, I wanted to get to know you a bit."
"Oh, I see, sir," she said, and started to unzip her ship suit.
"And you wanted Miss Jaxton to watch?"
No, I said. "Oh, understood, sir," she purred, and crossed to the helm. "We're used to working together, aren't we, dear?" she said to Miss Jaxton with a soft hand on her arm. "Oh, yes," she replied, and started to reach for her own zip.
"Ladies,"
I barked in a desperate attempt to get the watch back under control.
"Sar?"
Miss Dang looked at me curiously. She turned to rest her rump on the console beside Miss Jaxton. Her shipsuit was already unzipped to the waist, and way too much of her torso was exposed to make me feel comfortable. She didn't appear to be wearing a ship tee under her suit. "It's quite lovely, I'm sure," I said, more than a bit flustered by the unexpected turn of events, but that wasn't precisely what I had in mind.
"Oh, you can join us, sir," Miss Dang said.
"No," I barked too quickly. I took a deep breath while they looked at me with confused expressions that were beginning to make me very, very angry, and not at them. I let it out and started over. "I'm sorry. I wasn't very clear, and it's obvious that common practice aboard is not what I'm used to," I told them. "Please zip it, and we'll start over." Miss Dang looked confused, while Miss Jaxton looked at me with a frown of concentration. Obviously, this wasn't going anywhere they were used to, either. Miss Dang zipped her ship suit, if not all the way up, at least far enough that it only offered moderate distraction. "Thank you," I told her. "Now, let me start again." I took another deep breath and began outlining what I wanted to accomplish during the watch.
It wasn't a long list, and when I was done, the two of them looked at each other, and then at me. "You're serious, Sar?" Miss Deng asked with what might have been a pout. "Yes, Miss Deng, I'm getting a little tired of this. I'm going to do something about it with your help." They exchanged another look. "Doesn't sound like as much fun as what I was thinking about," Miss Deng said with a twinkle in her eye, "but it'll certainly make for a change of pace." With a small giggle, she headed for the ladder. "I'll be right back, Sar. 3 ticks." "Thank you, Miss Deng," I told her, and she slipped quietly down the ladder. It was just past midnight, and we had almost 6 stands to make a difference. I intended to use every tick. Underway bridge watch tends to be really, really boring. Mostly during the night watches, crew are encouraged to study for ranking exams or even just read. What they're not allowed to do is sleep. The reality is that if you're anywhere on the bridge, you can pretty much do what you like. Apparently, that practice had gotten a little out of hand, and it bothered me a bit that these two spacers were quite so ready to engage in fraternization. It spoke volumes about the other male officers on the ship. I had a pang wondering if I was being sexist in that regard, but I had a hard time imagining Arletta ordering bets out of his ship suit on watch, and there was something about Mel and Freddy that made me think that we shared more commonality and outlook than I shared with, say, Mr. Burnside. Obviously, Deng and Jaxton were used to behaviors that I wasn't. But this was the first ship I'd been on that had bunk bunnies. I started rolling up my sleeves, and Ms. Deng returned from the janitor closet with the cleaning supplies we'd need. I set Jaxton, the tallest of the three of us, to work on the ports. The armor glass was smeared and in some places practically obscured by greasy hand, head, and even, in one case, what looked like a butt print. Idly, I wondered how that particular fundamental anatomy could have been elevated high enough to be placed there, but decided in the end that was something I really didn't want to know. Deng and I split the consoles and did a first-level wipe down of the screens and horizontal surfaces. I got the broom out of the locker in the back of the bridge and proceeded to sweep the loose dirt from the deck corners into a pile in the back of the bridge. "I didn't even know that locker existed," Ms. Deng exclaimed. I chuckled. "Every ship's bridge has one. You just need to know it's there to look for it." Jaxton finished the last of the glass about the time Deng and I finished the consoles and deck. There was a lot of armor glass, and it took close to 4 stands to get through the whole evolution. We were all three filthy and tired from the effort, but the bridge looked more like the bridge of a real ship and not like some abandoned crap-trap. Freed of their loads of static-charged dust, the screens and repeaters glowed with new vibrancy. The light glinted off the desktops, and the deep dark was revealed in all of its majesty through armor glass that was once again transparent. We all just stood there in the middle of the bridge, admiring our handiwork. "There now, isn't that better?" I asked finally. "Well, Mr. Huang, I have to say you give new meaning to the phrase getting down and dirty," Ms. Jaxton joked. Ms. Deng was seized with a huge yawn, but laughed afterwards and said, "I think I liked my idea better, but this was certainly a change." "Okay," I said. "Ms. Deng, if you'd be so kind as to run down to the mess deck and grab us some coffee, make sure to get it from the urn closest to the galley. I take mine with a bit of milk and 2 sugars. "Aye, sir," she said, and scampered down the ladder. After she left, Ms. Jaxton resumed her seat at the helm and glanced shyly at me. I'm sorry, sir. For before. I wasn't sure which before she was talking about. "Before, Ms. Jaxton." "Yes, sir. On the mess deck the other day." "Water under the bridge, Miss Jaxton. You didn't know me. I didn't know you. Chalk it up to experience and move on, shall we?" "Yes, sir," she said, sounding a little relieved. "Thank you, sir." "One other thing, Miss Jaxton." "Yes, sir?" she asked curiously. "Call me old-fashioned, but I don't screw with crew. Ever. It's nothing personal. It's just the way I work." "Yes, sir," she said. Miss Deng returned with 3 cups of coffee then, and we settled down to sip and admire the deep dark. "So you found my little present?" Mr. Burnside said as he relieved me at 1745. "Sorry?" I really had no idea what he was talking about. He pointed to the console. "I left you a little something since you were having so much fun cleaning." "Oh, that," I shrugged. "Forgot all about it, but thanks for your consideration." I tried to keep my voice carefully neutral. He just snickered, but then his expression changed as if he'd suddenly remembered something. He motioned me over to the bridge wing where we could have a bit of privacy. "I talked to Aponis this afternoon," he began. "Really? Something I should be aware of?" I asked. "Yes, actually." He paused. "You are out of line." He said it very seriously. I was out of line. I repeated it back, trying to figure out if I'd seen Aponis some other time during the day than when he and Mosler were assaulting Nart. "What exactly did you talk to Mr. Aponis about?" "The little incident in the gym." He was giving me the stern, superior to junior officer look. I glanced over to where Mallory was relieving Jaxton, and Burnside stepped into my line of sight, backing me up into the bridge wing a little further and blocking my view. "I'm talking to you, Wong," he said sharply but softly. "You are not to interfere with my watch standards, ever. Are we clear?" He bit off each word. "Interfere with your watch standards?" It shouldn't have surprised me, but the sheer stupidity of it took me off balance. "Aponis and Mosler were assaulting Nart," I said, trying to keep my voice down. "What was I supposed to do?" "Walk away," he said. "Aponis is on my watch. If there is a problem, you come to me." I stared at him. "Do you hear me, Wong?" He was right in my face. "You must be joking," I said. "You think I'm going to walk away?" He cut me off with a hard fist, once, right up under my ribcage, which drove me back into the bulkhead and left me trying to suck air back into my lungs. The pain was amazing, and I thought I was going to keel over right there. "Be quiet, Wong," he snapped. "Listen, listen good. You do not ever interfere." I was sagged against the bulkhead. If he hadn't been standing so close to me, my feet probably would have slid out from under me. My world was narrowed to a gray tunnel and an aching gut punch. After one last glower in my face, he turned back to the bridge and stepped over to the console. "I have the watch, Mr. Wong. Logged at 2358, July 18th, at 1745 per standing order." He announced it loudly. Juliet knew something was wrong. Something about the way I was leaning against the bulkhead, or perhaps it was the redness in my face and the way I was trying to wheeze air back into my lungs. She started to say something, but I caught her eye and shook my head once, nodding at the ladder. I managed to stumble upright and cross the bridge without staggering. I did stumble a little on the bottom of the ladder where she was waiting. She caught me by the arm. "Are you all right, Sar?" she asked. I managed a weak chuckle as her question echoed mine from earlier in the day. It was, rather, an inane question when viewed from this side. The movement was easing the cramp, though, and I was able to get almost a full breath again. "A little disagreement with the first mate," I said. "Nothing to be concerned about." She eyed me dubiously. "Anybody ever tell you you're a terrible liar, Sar?" she asked after a moment. "Yes, Miss Jaxton, they have, on numerous occasions. I keep practicing in hopes that someday I'll get better." She nodded. "Keep practicing, Sar." She glared up the ladder and then back at me. "Miss Jaxton," I said, gathering her attention, "it's almost time for dinner, Mess. Shouldn't you be heading in that direction?" "Yes, Sar," she said. "I was just waiting to see if you'd fall down when you let go of the ladder rail, Sar. It's not often you get to see an officer fall over from a little disagreement, and I thought it might be instructive, Sar." I snorted, a soft, painful laugh. The sudden contraction stabbed at me, but at least my sense of humor wasn't permanently damaged. "Have you ever considered the academy, Miss Jaxton?" I asked. "Me? No. What would make you say something like that?" I shook my head and could feel the crooked grin on my face. "No particular reason, Miss Jaxton." I let go of the ladder and walked with as much dignity as I could down the passage. Behind me I heard Juliet snort, but head for the mess deck. I let myself into my stateroom without falling down or throwing up. I could hear the shower running in the head, so I sat down on my bunk and curled up around the pane, letting myself deal with it for the first time now that I had a little privacy. In a few ticks the shower cut off, and after a few more I heard a soft rap. I straightened up from the near-fetal curl and tried to compose myself a bit before I reached up and released the latch. Arletta was in her terry robe and still rubbing her hair with a towel. "How was... My gods, what happened to you?" she said. "Oh, hiya, neighbor," I said lightly. "Hiya, neighbor? That's my answer?" she asked. She was frowning at me, but it looked more concerned than angry. What makes you think anything happened? I asked, trying to sit upright but still feeling my shoulders curling inward. She said in a considering tone. Might have something to do with the fact that you're sitting there hunched over like somebody kicked you in the jewels and your face looks like you've been punched in the gut. I nodded appreciatively. 1 out of 2, not a bad average. She blinked at me as she processed what I was saying. Somebody kicked you in the jewels? She asked incredulously. No, punched in the gut, I said, and stopped trying to pretend it didn't hurt. Who punched you in the gut? She asked. When I didn't answer right away, she said, Burnside. She made the name a curse. I sighed and nodded. I interfered with his watchstander. You what? She asked, but then almost immediately added, This is about Nart, isn't it? Yeah, I admitted. Apparently. I looked up at her. How do you know about it? Ula came to me this afternoon, she said. Thanks for standing up for her, but you have to be more careful. Those two are bad news. They're crew, I said. They're mean, vicious, and stupid, she spat. Being an officer won't protect you from that. Nor from Burnside, apparently, I said. What happened? She stepped into my stateroom and took the guest chair. She smelled wonderful. Warm, clean, soapy. I tried not to think too much about her bare knees poking out from the bottom of her robe. When he came to relieve the watch, I said, focusing on her eyes, he twitted me about what a mess he'd left on the bridge and called it his little present since I liked cleaning so much. Wait, he what? She interrupted. He left a mess on the console, apparently on purpose so I'd have something to clean. I shrugged and winced. Stupidly juvenile, coffee on both sides of the desk. Took a whole tick to clean up. If he does that to me, she started, but petered off as I just looked at her. Yeah, well. After that, he took me over to the bridge wing, and we had a little discussion over my interference with his watchstander. He backed me into the corner there, and while Mallory was relieving the watch, he snuck one up under my ribcage. What were you supposed to do? Those thugs were assaulting a crewman, she asked, getting angry by the tick. His words? Walk away, I said. You can't do that. It's illegal, she said. What, like punching an officer? Well, that's illegal too, but if you'd walked away and something happened, if it came out that you'd been there and done nothing, they'd take away your ticket. At least, I agreed. At least, she said. But you're forgetting one thing, I pointed out. What? Who's the law here? We're governed by the rules and regulations set forth by the Confederated Planets Joint Committee on Trade. That's illegal, she sputtered. But who's the law here? I asked again, with the emphasis on here. Rosset, she said, her indignation collapsing as the reality hit her. It's only illegal if you can make a case to the authorities, I pointed out. We can't do anything in space, and we'll have no standing once we make port if the captain won't back us. We sat there, silently contemplating the situation. He's going to be even more insufferable, you know, she said. Which one, I asked. Burnside or Aponis? She closed her eyes in resignation. I was thinking Burnside, but you're right. My tablet pinged to remind me that it was almost time for dinner in the wardroom. Arletta stood and slipped back through the door to the head. I better get dressed, she said. Grab a quick shower and I'll walk down with you. I nodded and she closed the door on her side as I slipped gingerly out of my clothes and into the shower. The hot water felt good.
2 weeks out of Breakall when I finally completed the software hack that let me turn the intercoms on and off whenever I moved from one space to another within the ship. I'd discovered some dead spots in the process, and even, out of boredom more than anything, added a patch to turn on the lights when I entered my stateroom. In all that time, nobody else ever turned on a mic. The study sessions were still going on in the mess deck every day. A couple of the crew had to step back and evaluate their process towards skipping a rating. I thought it was interesting that it was something that they did among themselves and then told me about it after they'd decided. A few people, mostly Mosler and Aponis, still glowered. They really didn't like it that their ability to intimidate their shipmates was so severely curtailed. It was good to see the crew becoming more cohesive, more supportive of each other. I smiled, thinking that perhaps it was going to work out after all. "Something funny, sir?" Juliet asked, breaking into my reverie. "Yes, Miss Jackson. I was just thinking about being a girly man and how much things have changed in the last few weeks," I told her. "Oh, you're considering a change then, sir?" she asked, with a twinkle in her eye. "Gonna cross the fence?" Charlotte snorted from her side of the bridge. "You have some contribution, Miss Deng?" I asked sternly.
No, sir, not me, sir. She looked up from her tablet, grinning. So tell me, I said, a bit more seriously, what's the news below decks? The two women exchanged glances and Juliet shrugged. News, sir? Charlotte asked. Is there anything in particular you're interested in? I looked back and forth between them, not sure how far I could go with them. How's life aboard? I asked tentatively. Has it gotten any better? It was apparently Juliet's turn to snort. I don't know that it could have gotten much worse, sir, she said. Running some of the more egregious possibilities through my mind, I wondered if she was being a bit harsh. Charlotte picked up from Juliet's lead. We haven't had anybody seriously injured or killed this trip, she said. Yet, Juliet added. True, Charlotte responded with a small nod, but except for a couple of the stupider members of the crew, I think there's a lot less tension. Getting people together on the mess deck in the afternoon has done a lot for morale. She shrugged. I can't explain it. Juliet added, It's made a lot of difference in the berthing areas. She looked at me with a kind of an apologetic half-smile. There's a lot less bunk jumping. People seem to be pairing up. Charlotte coughed. Well, that's probably not the right word. Forming groups? She looked at Charlotte, who shrugged agreement. At any rate, there's a lot less random carnality with the accompanying bad feelings and black eyes. I blinked and decided I really did not need to know what kind of circumstances led to random carnality in the first place. I couldn't decide if it was something specific to the Billy or if bunk bunny culture was inherently askew. It's harder to get into a bunk when you're not wanted these days, for sure, Charlotte said, especially when it's already full, she added with a wink. I couldn't be sure if Juliet blushed or not. She was paying very close attention to her helm. I see, I said neutrally. Thank you for that insight. You're welcome, sir, Charlotte said. Anytime. I settled back down to my watch logs while Juliet and Charlotte returned to their studies. When 1745 rolled around, Burnside and Mallory clambered up the ladder to the bridge. After just having decided that I really was just being paranoid, I couldn't help but brace myself. Burnside walked over to the watchstander station and flopped bonelessly in the chair, though. For once he didn't stink of sex, but he didn't look all that lively either. "Ship is on course and on tar," I started to say. "I relieve you," Burnside interrupted. Then he put his head back and closed his eyes. I shrugged and followed Juliet down the ladder. We separated at the passageway, and she headed down to the mess deck. I made a beeline for my stateroom. We had 12 stands off and didn't need to be back on duty until 0600 the next morning. I was looking forward to a good meal and then a good night's sleep. Even passing Simon in the passageway outside the cabin no longer seemed strange to me. Dinner in the wardroom was a convivial affair to begin with. Arletta and I arrived a bit early. Freddie was already there with her tablet open and reading. She put it up when we breezed in the door. "How are you, Freddie?" I asked happily. "Fine," she smiled. "Just catching up on the sector's trading situation. Hasn't changed much since the last time we were here," she added. Mel joined us with a hearty "good evening" and a warm smile around the table. "How is everyone?" She walked around to her place, patting Freddie on the shoulder as she passed. Arletta was looking alert and rested as well as she might. It was her day off and hadn't had to deal with the ship that much. She returned Mel's smile with a grin and said, "A few more days and we can get off this tub for a while." "Aw," Mel said with mock sadness, "you don't like the Billy." "Oh, it's not that," Arletta said with a wicked grin. "I just think we should see other people." Penny Davis brought in the trays and we set to. There wasn't a lot of gusto, but it was filling and warm. That counted. I also think I was finally getting to the point where the food was the food and my mind wasn't looking for more than filling and warm. Whatever else one might find fault with, the food was always filling and warm. It was a typical Burnside-free meal with fun companions and pleasant banter. For all my dark trepidations about the ship, I was feeling a little foolish about my concerns. Afterwards, I headed back to my stateroom and began taking advantage of the long break between watches by stripping down to my skivvies and crawling into my bunk. I must have been tired because I don't remember actually laying down. When the tap-tap-tap on my stateroom door woke me, I immediately thought I'd overslept and missed relieving the watch. It was one of those recurring nightmares that plague watchstanders, like missing the final exam haunts students. That little spike of adrenaline left me confused, but I managed to say, "Yeah?" loudly enough to be heard on the other side while I was still blinking my eyes into focus. I heard a woman's voice say, "Mr. Huang, it's Davies." "One tick," I told her, and scrambled out of my bunk and into a ship suit. The chrono said 22:50. When I opened the door, Penny Davies was standing there, nervously looking both ways up and down the passageway. She glanced at my face and said, "Sorry to bother you, sir, but may I come in?" I backed into my stateroom to give her a chance to enter. She slipped in with another glance at my face and a grateful smile. She closed the door behind her, and I had a moment of doubt. She didn't come into the room any further than was absolutely necessary, but stood there just inside the door, playing with her fingers nervously and looking down. "Okay, Miss Davies," I prompted softly. "I'm almost awake. What's up?" I backed up a little further, but didn't try to sit. I didn't want to sit on the bunk, and the side chair was the only other seat. "I'm sorry, sir," she said again. I could see her working up her nerve for something, and I was pretty sure I did not want to know what it was. "I want to be in your harem, sir," she said, without looking up. I scrubbed my face with my hands and sighed. It was not an auspicious start to the conversation. "I don't have a harem, Miss Davies," I said gently. "Oh, yes, sir," she said softly, with little glances flicking up from the deck to my face and then back down again. I know you don't have a harem like that, sir, but there are some that think you do, and I'd like them to think that I'm part of it so they'll leave me alone." "Just tell them to leave you alone, Miss Davies," I said naively. "They can't force you, can they?" She did look up at me then, a stricken look in her face. "Yes, sir, they can," she said matter-of-factly. "You're in a nice stateroom by yourself. I sleep in deck berthing. They most certainly can." She lowered her eyes to the deck again. I blinked stupidly. Of course they could. I was being dense. "I suppose I can't ask who," I prompted. "I'd rather not say, sir," she answered. "I have to live there." "Of course," I said, scrubbing the back of my neck with one hand, trying to force a stream of logic through my sleep-bogged brain. "Sir," she pleaded after half a tick, "I don't know where else to go." "Why me?" I asked finally. "Why not Miss Maness?" "Because you keep your people safe, sir," she said softly. Her response surprised me. "What makes you think Miss Maness doesn't?" She snorted at me and gave the "you've got to be kidding" look. "Because she can't, sir," she said. "And you think I can?" I asked, trying to find some kind of footing in this conversational bog. "You do, sir, yes," she replied instantly. I sighed again. "How do you propose to join my so-called harem?" I asked after a few heartbeats. She shrugged, a little nervously. "Well, sir, if I spent the night here a few times," she started to say softly. "Whoa," I said. She stopped and flickered a few of those furtive glances up toward my face again. "You know I don't really have a harem," I said softly. She gave a small nod. "You know I don't sleep with my watch section," I added. She gave another small nod. "But I'm not on your watch section, sir. I'm not even in your division," she pointed out. I thought, maybe. Her voice tapered off. I sighed again. "I don't screw with crew, Miss Davies," I said at last, trying to make it as gentle as I could. "Any crew." She winced and said, "Well, we wouldn't have to do anything, sir." There was a note in her voice now that had gone over the edge into pleading. "You want to spend the night in my stateroom so you can convince people that you're part of my harem," I pointed out. "Do you think people will believe we're not sleeping together?" "No, sir," she said. "I suspect they will. That would be the whole idea." "But I don't have a harem," I came back to the logic. I kept trying to get back there, but I wasn't having any luck. "Maybe you could start one, sir," she said softly. "I know others who'd like to join." I did sit on the edge of my bunk then. It occurred to me that this might be a nightmare, that I really was still asleep. "Why?" I asked finally. "So you'll protect me, sir," she said simply, "like you protect Ulla and Charlotte and Juliet." "Ulla?" I asked. "Ulla Nart?" "Yes, sir," she said with another of her little nods. "They stopped bothering her after you stood up to a Mosler and opponents in the gym. Everybody thinks she's in your harem and they leave her alone." With that, we had moved out of nightmare country and into surreal. I didn't even know where to go from that point. "Sir," she pleaded, "please, I'll sleep on the deck, anything." There was a desperation in her voice that kept me off balance. "I just can't keep going on like this," she said with a half sob. "Just tell them no," I said a bit forcefully. She looked up at me again with one of those "you can't be saying that" looks on her face. "Tell them no," she asked, her voice rising a little. "Tell them no to this." She reached up and unzipped her suit, stripping it back to show she wasn't wearing a ship tee under it. It was too fast for me to protest, and what she showed me stopped me cold. She was a patchwork of bruises, some fresh and dark, some a yellow color, some were just a minor discoloration on her skin. Mixed in were what looked like bites and scratches. "Do you think I don't tell them no, sir?" she asked, staring into my face. "Do you really think telling them no makes a difference?" I had a hard time catching my breath. Behind me, I heard Arletta moving around in the head. I glanced at the chrono, 23:15. She'd be getting ready to go on watch. She tapped on the door, and I reached over to release the latch without thinking. She opened the door and stuck her head in. "You okay-ish? I thought I heard..." She expected to find me lying in my bunk, and when she turned her head to look at me, I could see her eyes focus on the figure trying to get her ship suit back up over her shoulders. "I know you're on your way to watch, Ms. Novaya, but if you could spare a couple of ticks," I said. "Miss Davies here wants to join my harem." She pushed the door open a little more, and the extra light from the head made the bruises and bites stand out more against the pale skin. Davies finally got her ship suit back on and zipped, but not before Arletta had seen. "Now what?" she asked me. "I was hoping you'd have some ideas," I told her.
"Nothing happens. It's easy to begin to convince yourself that it was all a paranoid delusion. While the old syllogism about paranoia is undoubtedly valid and they are all out to get you, the reality is that sometimes paranoia is just a state of mind. You see something, you jump to conclusions. It's self-defense." We were still about 10 days short of Diurnia at last, and it looked like we'd make it back without any further difficulties. Burnside's attempts to woo Miss Kramer were being ineffectual. I had it on good authority that remembering what happened to his last girlfriend made it easy to ignore his tablet bips. There had been no more assaults reported, and the Bumble brothers had limited their hostility to a continual sneer, punctuated with the odd glare for good measure. Mostly, they were being ignored. We'd come through transition without any problems. The captain had come out of his cabin for the half a stand that he needed to be on the bridge, and then disappeared down the ladder and into the cabin again. For mercy, he hadn't called me down to strip my hide for anything. I rather expected to hear about how many of the crew had earned their ratings advances, but he didn't say anything. My tablet continued to turn on intercom transducers as I moved around the ship. The audio logs were an amusing map of my day and week. I only hoped that I hadn't said or done anything incriminating. The alarm that I'd placed on them had never been tripped. It was uncanny, although I suppose it made some sense, considering that none of the crew had been aboard when the ship was commissioned. "Did you hear about Zhang?" Charlotte's voice broke into my reverie. I glanced up from the watch station and looked at her across the bridge. "No. What about Zhang, Miss Deng?" I asked. "Seems he broke his arm," she said. Juliet was at the helm, and she snickered. "Unfortunate accident?" I asked. She shrugged. "Alone in the gym. Reportedly, he fell off the treadmill." I raised an eyebrow in her direction. "Does that seem likely, Miss Deng?"
"Absolutely, sir," she replied. Footsteps on the ladder resolved into Mallory, and Burnside wasn't far behind. We relieved the watch, and I went to bed very shortly after dinner. Normally I'd have run or done a couple of sets of Tai Chi, but I was exhausted and really only wanted to crawl into my bunk. I stripped out of my ship suit and clambered into said bunk, pulling the covers over me and dropping into sleep like a rock into a pond. I dreamt about a wolf and a fox playing tag in the woods and a falcon soaring in a crystal sky. A graceful heron stood on the edge of the pond and flashed to snatch a silvery fish. It wasn't a very clear or cogent dream, but in the end a fierce owl with brilliant green eyes dived at my face, talons outstretched toward my eyes. I woke with a start, sure that I'd heard something. I lay there for a few heartbeats, trying to place the sound. I half expected it to be the bip-bip-bee of my tablet alarm. I blinked my eyes open enough to see the chrono's glowing digits. 0036. The sound didn't repeat, so I sighed and snuggled back down into the bunk. I still had a few stands I could sleep, and I hoped the weird dream didn't start up again. I closed my eyes and started to slip back into the warm darkness, watching the afterimages of my stateroom playing against the back of my eyelids. Just in time, I recognized the shape of two people standing inside my door. Only their marginally darker shapes against the darkness of the door gave them away as the afterimages faded off the inside of my eyelids.
I rolled off the bunk and onto the floor as the first fist slammed into the mattress where I'd been laying. Of course, that dropped me onto the feet of my attackers, and with nowhere else to go, they fell on top of me in a heap when my weight and momentum caught them off guard. They were as tangled in themselves as they were in me, and that gave me a moment to wriggle out of the pig pile and scramble to the doorway. I flung open the door and slapped the light switch at the same time. The glaring overhead light flared and cast a pool of light out into the dimmed passage. I turned to look over my shoulder and saw Ponies and Mosler tangled in the narrow area beside my bunk. They were blinking from the sudden glare and trying to find where I'd gone. Mosler had a hand up, rubbing the back of his head where he'd apparently found the edge of my desk as he'd fallen. I was still marveling that they'd be so stupid as to try to get at me in my own stateroom when my training kicked in and I heard the movement behind me. I stepped to the side, and a hard fist, backed up by a burly forearm, flashed past my face and crashed into the bulkhead. I heard the distinct sound of small bones snapping, even over the thud of the blow into the wall, and the subsequent wail of pain. Burnside was right beside me, but he was no longer looking at me. The pain in the hand he'd driven against the wall was claiming the lion's share of his attention. He bit down on the noise and pulled his hand back to his chest, trying to protect it. Behind me, I could hear Mosler and Aponis crawling out from under the desk and heading in my direction. They gained their feet, and Aponis had a look on his face that said several bad words without actually uttering a sound. They rushed me, the pair of them. I thought for a heartbeat that they'd bind up in the narrow door, but Mosler hung back just enough to put his shoulder behind Aponis and give him that little extra momentum. It was like watching a freight train coming straight at me, and I knew it was going to hurt like hell when they hit. Tai Chi is like that, though. The basic idea is that it's difficult for an opponent to hurt you if you don't stand still for the blow. I shifted my weight to my back leg and let my torso pivot around as the two burly crewmen exploded out of my stateroom. I felt Aponis' lowered shoulder just slide across my upper body as I turned. The full mass and momentum of the two heavy men sailed past me and into the stationary figure of Burnside, who was still trying to get his mind around the pain in his broken hand. They collided with his broken hand, driving it into his own sternum, before pushing him backwards across the passageway, where he slammed against the bulkhead hard enough to rattle the ship. I heard sounds from Freddy's and Mel's staterooms, and in the only really conscious decision I made in the previous tick, I stepped back into my own stateroom and closed the door, even before the tangle of groaning men slid to the deck. All I could hear outside was quiet curses and groans, and once, something that sounded like a slap. My tablet bipped, and I retrieved it from the shelf above my bunk. It was a note from Mel. "You okay?" it asked. I sent back, "So far." "Anything I can do?" came back once more. "Not tonight," I sent. "Let's talk tomorrow." I heard the commotion in the passageway getting sorted out, and I braced myself against the door. They didn't try again, though, and I heard them scuffling down toward Burnside's stateroom and the sound of a closing door. I let out the breath I'd been holding since stepping back into the room, and seriously considered how I was going to secure the door against further attacks.
And a cargo lined up. Burnside had
I could already feel the ship beginning to come to life. I stood on the bridge waiting for the last import backups to finish when the captain came up the ladder and we stood together looking aft out into the deep dark. "It's a lovely sight, isn't it, Ishmael?" she asked. "Well, I haven't grown tired of it yet, Captain," I told her with a satisfied smile. "When I first started, I thought I might." I could see her smile in the faint reflection of the armor glass. Seeing her standing there, eyes gleaming in the light of the displays, serene in the mantle of captain, she was magnificent, and I felt honored to be in her company. I slipped a small bundle from the pocket of my ship suit and offered it to her. She looked at it, laying there in my open palm, and then at me. "What's this?" "I think this belongs to you, Captain," I told her. "I've been carrying it for a long time." "What is it?" she asked, curiosity lighting her face. I held my hand up closer to her. "Open it and see," I said. She lifted it delicately from my palm and examined the string and wrappings in the lowered light, holding it up and turning it this way and that. She turned to me and said, "Thank you." "Well, you don't know what it is yet," I said, chuckling in protest. Her face crinkled in a smile, and she pulled the string that loosed the knot. She carefully unrolled the soft fabric from around the small figure within. I could hear her breath catch, and the glinting lights from the displays gleamed off the polished wood and reflected on the bit of shell at the heart. In her hand, an owl sat perched on a stylized limb, the lambent glow around us showing the delicately carved feathering and the graceful curves of the head and the back. Talons gripped the wood, each toe articulated to show the power in that wooden grasp.
"Is it a Welkie?" she asked.
"Yes, Captain."
"I've heard of them," she said, wonder in her voice as she turned it this way and that to catch the light. "I thought they were a myth."
I held up my dolphin. "No myth, Captain," I told her. Her eyes widened slightly at the smooth, oiled wood of the dolphin, and she glanced into my eyes and back to the dolphin, then back to her owl.
"How?" she asked.
"Long story, but the Lois visited St. Cloud while I was on her. I got these on that trip, along with some others. I intended them as trade goods, but I was never able to sell them."
"This is worth a fortune, Ishmael," she said, blinking in realization of what she held in her hand. "I can't possibly. Do you know the story of Welkies, Captain?" I asked her.
"Story?" she asked.
"Legend has it that the Welkie finds the person who needs it," I said.
"Then what does it do?" she asked.
I shrugged. "I don't know. It's kind of a totem, perhaps a spirit guide. The shaman carves the spirit of the animal out of the wood and places the shell to give it heart. The deeper the purple of the shell, the more powerful the spirit."
My words sounded odd in that technological space. Two people around a flickering fire of display monitors and console repeaters. We stood in the internal night of space, in a bubble of air held by fragile metal, glass, and composite shell. I felt a moment of almost dizziness as I realized that while the planet seemed huge when compared to the ship, they weren't that much different in size when compared to the vastness of the deep dark. Both just pinpricks of life. Both fragile.
"Why me?" she asked at last, breaking the dim silence that held us together.
"I don't know," I answered. I could feel the smile tugging my lips. "It just seemed right to me." She gazed at it for a moment and then looked at me.
"Thank you, Ishmael," she said at last.
"You're welcome, Captain."
We stood there on the bridge, the moment passing. Reality edged back into the world around us. She carefully rewrapped the Welkie and tied it off again, slipping it into a pocket of her ship suit. I just held my dolphin, as I had so often before. The smooth wood was warm from my touch.
"Why did you decide to go to the Academy?" she asked, after a couple of ticks. I snorted. "Alice Jagone is a very persuasive woman."
She chuckled at that. "Yes, she is, but still, why?"
"We had a saying on the Lois McKendrick," I told her. "We used to say, trust Lois. Whenever things went wrong or right or east or west and we didn't know what to do, we'd say, trust Lois. And everybody would do what needed to be done. And we pulled through."
"So you applied that principle to going to the Academy," she said.
"Yes. A lot of people thought I should go. People I respected. Even loved. They thought it was something that would be good for me, and even if I couldn't see it, I needed to trust Lois. So I went to the Academy."
She looked at me for several heartbeats, weighing me with her gaze.
"You're a dangerous man, Mr. Huang," she said at last.
"A very dangerous man."
Thank you all for listening to Double Share. Now that the story is over, please let me know how you liked it. If you got the book through patiobooks.com, please rate it on its title page. If you're listening through iTunes, please take a couple of ticks and leave a review. I'd love to hear from each of you. The music is a collection of jigs used by permission of the band Great Big Sea. Find this and other songs by Great Big Sea on music.podshow.com or on the band's website at greatbigsea.com. This has been a presentation from Durandus, offered under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 U.S. license. To learn more about the Golden Age of the Solar Clipper, visit the Trader's Diary at www.solarclipper.com. Thanks again for listening.